Welcome to another episode of Before You Kill Yourself with your host, Leo Flowers. I am Leo Flowers. Today's guest is Wendy Beth, who is a transformative force whose nurturing spirit and unwavering dedication to personal and collective growth shaped her journey of awakening and resilience, inspiring others to reach greater heights of love and authenticity. She is a soul guide and founder of Living Blueprint, helping others work through anxiety, sexual trauma, addiction, confusion, grief, and suicidal ideation. All obstacles that she has overcome is her gift. Utilizing a degree in family science, Wendy Beth offers her true story. Plus, she has a 40-day guide, so that you can, discover your true story also. Welcome to the podcast, Wendy Beth.
Thank you, Leo. Thank you for having me.
I'd like to start off with this solo trip that you took in your 50s. The amount of adventure that must have had. What led up to that? Why solo? As a woman, soloing, how dare you?
Well, my youngest child was dancing in Blackpool, England at the World Championships, ballroom dancing. And so I had saved some money. I'd just gone through a divorce. I'd saved some money from some art that I had created and decided to go over. And I had about a month between when I finished classes in my degree and when he was going to be dancing. And I just bought a one-way ticket to Paris. And once I got there, then my flatmates were talking about all these different places in Europe. And I said, one of them was talking about Morocco. So that was someplace I'd always wanted to go. So I bought a one-way ticket to Morocco and it just kind of started there. And I just started exploring.
I love that. I'm reading about Freya Stark, who late 1800s, early 1900s was a huge explorer and wrote about it in her books. And your energy and your story remind me of her. And also this book Candide that I'm reading, where this woman had so many traumatic experiences, being stabbed, raped, assaulted, flogged, exiled. And yet she didn't refer to them as traumatic experiences. She referred to them as adventures, which I thought was a way to kind of reframe it. You know, in your bio, you talked about how addiction, sexual trauma, and grief, confusion, all these things are part of your story. How do you frame? Do you frame it as traumatic experiences, or how do you frame your experiences as you look back?
Learning opportunities. They are more information for me now. But then I'm in my mid-50s, so I've had a lot of time to process a lot of things that happened to me. And especially up until I was about 20 or 21, you know, a lot of that was just a blur. It was just a blur. And now I see them, especially the relationship I had with my mother. It was so, she just passed away recently, and she and I had such a traumatic, such a stressful life together. But she taught me so much, and being her daughter made me resilient. It made me resilient being her daughter.
That word resilient, what does that mean to you? When I think about resilience, I think of it how quickly one can bounce back to neutral or to where you were. When you think about resilience, how are you defining that for yourself?
I would define resilience as the ability to come back, learn from what you're going through. So resilience is the ability to learn and shine through whatever it is you're going through. I feel like we can survive, but resilience to me is more than just surviving. It's really thriving on the other side of whatever we're going through.
When you talk about addiction being part of your story, walk me through that. What's the genesis? Are we talking drugs, porn?
Work? So as a teenager, I got addicted to drugs very quickly. It was definitely self-medicating. Somebody offered me some pills. I started taking them, and there wasn't really a stop button in me, Leo. I would just use and use, and it just continually got worse from in high school. And then right before I turned 18, my parents put me in treatment, and I stayed sober for a few months after that. And then I started using again, and I used heavily as a self, not really as a, to ever enjoy just using, just it was self-medicating. It was just to numb the pain until I actually got pregnant with my son. And having this baby in my body changed me. I just wanted this child to have a clean environment to grow in utero. I just wanted this child to have this space that they could grow. And then once I became a mother, I could never use after that, because I just wanted to create this life for this child. And in supporting my child having the best life I could give, you know, ultimately I also helped myself.
Was that a pregnancy? I know this is a strange question, but was that a pregnancy that you wanted? And I'm asking that because oftentimes we don't realize that the purpose is in the pain or in the thing that we don't expect, right? If you weren't expecting to get pregnant, you're like, what do I do with this baby? How am I going to survive? And you don't realize that this baby was brought to you to help you beat the addiction, but you don't know that at the moment. You know,
I didn't know that at the moment, but I will tell you, the love and the core part of who I am, which is a nurturer, which I didn't know that before, but that core essence of who Wendy Beth is, which is a nurturer, that came alive when I had this other human to take care of. And I just, that the love that I felt for that child was bigger than any, it was bigger than any pain. It was bigger. I didn't need to self-medicate anymore. The love that I had for that child was stronger than the pain.
It's so funny because I just have been, you know, I'm working on another webinar and presentation. And one of the things that I realized from listening to so many people's stories is just, it sounds like there's three levels. There's the pain that you're going through. And then if I can get you out of the pain, we can bring you into purpose, which is what the baby was. And then we can bring you into prosperity, which is, as you talked about, creating, building a life for yourself. And I think that sometimes people don't know where they are in that. Are they in pain? Because a lot of times when we're in pain, we are in the addiction. And so we're so numb, we don't know that we're in pain, right? So you almost have to feel the pain. The pain has to be so great for you to hopefully want to find your purpose and then move in. And sometimes the purpose is not something that you seek out. The purpose is something that just gets delivered to you. And you're like, oh, like you said, it was awakened, this nurturing part. Did you, had you not felt like that part had been activated in you at all before that?
I remember it as a small child, which is part of the beautiful process of healing, because I was able to go back and kind of look at who was I as a small child. As a kindergartner, I remember very clearly being reprimanded for helping others too much. Like, I wouldn't sit in my chair because I would finish my work and I would want to help others. I remember as a sibling wanting to make these pretend salads in the forest for my siblings. So as a little girl, this nurturing was part of who I was. And that got covered up with a lot of trauma, and then my own addiction, and then my own trauma. And so there was, you know, all these layers of wounds that when I had this baby started getting peeled away. And then after raising my children, to jump back to the solo international traveling, to travel and then be by myself in this world and have no reference points, that part of me, that the essence of who I was so present again. Just like when I got pregnant with my son, just like I was when I was a little girl.
You talked about the traumas that preceded the addiction. Can you walk us through that?
Well, my parents and I's relationship was extremely volatile. My father was an alcoholic. He was gone a lot, but when he was home, it was pretty traumatic when he was home. Most of my memories are violent. And my mom was so angry at life, and I was the scapegoat. She took it out on me. But she and my dad were doing their best. You know, at this point in my life, I understand. I have a lot of mercy for them. You know, I've raised my own family. I've had my own problems, and I really can see how they were both trying their best, but there was just, they had had their own trauma that wasn't healed. They had gone through their own pain that they were dealing with. My dad was self-medicating himself. You know, my mom was very religious, and I was not willing to just, I mean, I was just fighting the system. The system was broken and I was fighting it. There was sexual trauma involved. There was physical abuse. There was emotional abuse. There was mental abuse. And these were with people who were doing their best. They were really trying hard. But I didn't know that as a 16, 17, 18 year old, you know. It was just, they were reacting to their own pain, and they were reacting to me. And it was a pretty explosive home life. I started running away I ran away the first time when I was 16. I overdosed the first time when I was 16, overdosed again a year later, and then tried to end my life when I was 20, but survived suicide when I was 20.
Do you have siblings growing up?
I'm the oldest of 10.
Get out of here.
I am the oldest of 10. And my youngest sister, I remember I was 3 months away from having my oldest baby, or my oldest. And my mother was pregnant with my baby sister. So we never lived in a house together. We never... You know, she was born even after I was gone, but yes, I come from a large family. And actually we have I'm the oldest of 10. And then we also have a sister that my dad had from a previous marriage. So there's actually 11 of us.
Were you put into I could see this going a number of ways, being the oldest of 10. where typically the oldest child becomes the parentified child, the protector, the overseer. But I don't know if that dynamic holds true with 10 children. How did you feel? What did you feel like your role was? You said the nurturer, but were there other roles that you felt like you played being the oldest of 10?
Oh, I was, Leo, I was, the relationship between me and my mom was so toxic that I was always fighting. I was like a rabid animal, quite honestly. And it's interesting because when I talk to extended family, aunts and uncles and great aunts and great uncles, their view of me as a child was, you know, I was always cooking. I was always helping my mom. I was always the little mama. You know, they always told me that. I don't have any recollection of that. I don't really remember that. I remember hurting. I remember crying. I remember hiding. I remember there was so much pain. And you know, that spilled into my education as I went into middle school and high school. And then when the addiction started, I remember a lot of pain until I was 20. Well, and actually at 18, I met a woman and I got into a relationship with her, and I finally felt a little bit of safety. And my mom absolutely said no. I mean, she separated me from my siblings. My mom, like I said, was very religious. And she just said, no, you don't get to be a part of this family. You are nothing. You are evil. And I handled that for 2 years, and I tried to deal with that. And then there just came a point where at 20, there was no reason for, I just wanted everything to go black. I didn't have any belief system. I didn't know if I was going to hell. I just wanted everything to go black. I just wanted the pain to stop.
Going back to the rehab facility that you went to, and you get out, you relapse. When you look back at that experience, was there anything in that facility, any experience that you had in there that still resonates or helps you today? And is there something that you felt like you needed once you were released that you didn't receive? Like, was there something in that transition where you're like, that I could have used that right there?
Yeah. And it's one of the things that really has guided my path as an adult and is supporting other people. And that is that as a 17-year-old child, I kind of spilled my guts in treatment. Mm-hmm. Not realizing that I was going to go home to especially a father who was very angry that I had shared those things and was very angry that I had said the things I said. And, you know, there wasn't the safety. There wasn't the safety that I needed to be able to share what I shared. There wasn't the support system when I got out of treatment. To have been as vulnerable as I was, and, you know, very inexperienced. I didn't realize that. I can see that now. But I think one of the most important things that I learned through that and what I do now is if people are going to become very vulnerable, there has to be a safe place, especially young teenagers, for them to feel like they're safe when they get out of those facilities, that they have a support group, success partners out of those facilities, out of those situations.
How did he find out? I thought it was all confidential in there. Was it because of your age?
My age, because everything was, I mean, everything, I was only 17. So, and I will never forget when I got home, you know, he even said to me, there's no one here to protect you now. And he was really angry. And that to this day is very, I remember that. I want people to feel safe. If they're going to share, if they're going to be vulnerable, then they need to have a support system moving forward.
Looking back at your childhood, were there moments where you felt safe, or were there people who helped you to feel safe? Were there, even if it was a sliver or a word or...
When I was in kindergarten, I remember my Aunt Dot, she would pick me up from kindergarten and she would hold my hand and she would smile at me. I remember her smile really sticks with me. And then I remember I had a teacher, a third grade teacher, and she was kind to me. And, you know, I had teachers that were kind to me, but I was so hurting and so shut down. I was bullied and I never told anybody. I never told, you know, I talk about it in the book. I talk about some of the things that happened. I never told anybody. There was nobody to tell. I didn't tell those things until I got into that relationship when I was 18. And then I actually felt safe enough to say, you know, this happened when I was in seventh grade. This happened here.
You have 9 other siblings. Was there not a relationship with any of them? I mean, I just imagine like late night, parents are asleep. Now, what is it like 3 in a bed? I can't imagine you had an 11 bedroom house.
I do remember when we were just little, maybe 5, 6, 7, we would tickle each other's backs. And we would, you know, we would all be laying in a bed and then we would flip over. But I was the bad child. I really was. I was fighting the system, and my mother was so powerful, and she kind of did the same thing that she did when I fell in love with the woman, you know, and she said, you cannot be part of this family. You know, growing up, I had been so hurt that I was very disassociated. So I, even as a child, I wasn't really present. I was either fighting with my mom or, you know, and I just really wasn't very present.
You mentioned this
is kind of a shell of a person. I really was kind of a shell, just kind of trying to survive.
What was that like for you? Because you also mentioned confusion. Were you aware from a very early age that you preferred women, that you were attracted to women? Or was there like these mixed messages? I'd imagine if your mom's extremely religious, you're getting this, you know, Adam and Eve, not even Eve, kind of messages in the household.
No, I didn't have any of those feelings. I just met this woman and she... there was just this instant connection, and she was quite a bit older than I was. And I think I felt a safety with her. And I honestly, looking back, Leo, I feel like she was kind of my, a safe place. She was just a safe person for me to be able to land for a while. because I actually think maybe I probably, had I not been with her, I probably would have either accidentally drank myself to death or accidentally just used too many drugs, you know, because I there was just no stop. I was so disassociated from who I was at that point.
That feeling of safety, where is that located in your body typically? Where in your body do you know where you go, oh, I feel safe? And where in your body lets you know that you're not feeling safe?
So I think now I have this practice when I wake up in the morning. I start to breathe and I connect with me, Wendy Beth. And it's just this peaceful, calm place that is separate from all the circumstances of my life, all the relationships. It's just me. And I really connected with this place when I was solo traveling. I was in Morocco, and I was in this bed in this hostel, and I connected to this part of me that is just so still and so calm. And I really remember that place from being a tiny little girl when I was 3 and 4 years old. I remember that as a tiny, tiny child. And so that safety in me, it kind of feels like home. It's like deep inside of me, it's this feeling of home that I think is a universal feeling. I never really felt that as a child in my family home. And it's interesting, as an adult, I've spent my adult life trying to create that for my own family, you know, that feeling of home. But how I experience that is every single morning before I get out of bed, I experience that part of myself that is so still and calm, and it's connected to no one else. I even kick my husband out of bed, and he knows, you know, this is Wendy Beth's time to just connect to this part of her. And it's absolutely safe. I connect to that, and then I connect to my body. I will like give myself a hug. I'll rub my legs together. I rub my feet together just to really connect with my body. And then I connect with my source of inspiration. And that really helped. That is my safe place. That me in me and this body is my home, is my safe place, which is so the opposite of what it was before, because I was so, there was so much, there were so many layers of pain and memories and anger and resentment, but it's not there anymore.
How many kids do you have?
I have four.
Yeah, four. How have you taught them or tried to teach them about how to express their needs and their wants in a way that's very healthy, instead of, as you described your childhood, hiding and, you know, making yourself smaller, or, you know, even being active, just trying to be helpful as a way of walking on eggshells and making sure everything is good?
So as a mother, I really tried hard to create a home where my children felt safe, where they could feel that they were supported by their parents. I really worked hard to create their relationships with each other. That was such a deficit in my life, it's still, you know, I still feel that deficit in my life, but I really worked hard as a mom to help my children be each other's best friends. And I think that has been one of the things that's really worked. I think that I did that well. I think that they do connect to each other and they do reach out to each other. My children's personalities are very different. And I know that their memories as children, you know, we had a lot of fun as a family. I remember as a young mother watching another mother with teenagers, and they were having so many problems with their teenagers, just kind of like I had been a teenager, right? And this parent took away this child's guitar. And I thought at the time, that is the only thing that child wants right now is their guitar. Why would you take that away from them? And when I had teenagers, and I was struggling with one of my teenagers, I worked so diligently to just keep having moments of happiness together. You know, we had a family dog, so we'd play with that dog. We'd go snowboarding, we'd hike, and just continuing to have positive moments, even through the stressful times, I felt was really effective. And that child is today one of my dearest friends and someone that we have this amazing relationship with. So I guess to be very clear, I really love how I supported their relationships with each other and then continuing having happy moments, even through the hard times. I feel like that was really successful for them.
I love that idea of teaching them how to be each other's best friend. Like that, I've never heard that before. And I love that idea of, you know, four kids. Yeah. It's like, how do you support each other? And you know, and two of the things that seem to keep coming up is this idea of safety and of support. And I wonder for you, and being married, how long have you and your husband been together?
Well, we have kind of a funny, a beautiful story, actually. We were married for 25 years, and then we got divorced, which is when I went solo traveling in Europe. And we were divorced from 2017, and then we remarried in 2020. And so now we've been married from 2020 to 2024. So yeah, it is definitely my dream come true, because he and I struggled. You know, I mean, I had so much trauma when I came into the marriage. And so, but after years and years and years of healing, and then he and I were able to come back together, it's been definitely a dream come true.
Talk to me about the space in between, because I know that you went to Europe and you traveled and you did the solo traveling. That was part of the healing journey. Is there therapy involved? Is there ayahuasca? Is there, you know, what did you talk to other friends? Like, what were the insights that you had, or the changes you saw where you're like, all right, we can do this again?
Well, it's pretty clear. For me, I did not value myself. And I did not know how to hold a boundary. And I spent my whole life trying to make everyone else's life perfect. And there just came a point where I started loving myself. Honestly, Leo, it was that I really started realizing you have value. And we were so, my husband had been so hurt in our marriage because of my sexual trauma. And I'm really forthcoming in the book. I'm very vulnerable in the book. I'm very transparent of our issues. And so he had really kind of, you know, disassociated from me and the children. And I was pretty much on my own with the children anyway. He would always financially took care of us. But there just came a point where I did not love me. I knew that God loved me, and I knew I loved my children, but I did not love me. And my husband was so hurt from the marriage that though he loved me, he didn't really know how to value me. And I just finally chose divorce. And in the divorce, I had just these amazing experiences, namely when I was in Europe, you know, all of the labels and expectations and all of the programming and all of that, just when you're in a place where there's no reference points, you don't know the currency or where you're going, or you can't even read a map, or, and I was just placed in this, and I put myself in this place where there was just nothing that was familiar. And so the only thing that was left, Leo, was me, like the essence of me. And I remember waking up in Morocco, and I remember the smells, and I remember the colors. And I loved me like I had loved my children. You know, that's one thing I don't really, I loved my children so much for all those years. I was a full-time mom for 27 years. And without really ever loving or valuing me. And so I didn't really have healthy boundaries because of that. And so then as I really got stronger and really started loving me, I dated a lot. I fell in love a couple times. I had amazing sex. And, you know, my sex life had been so traumatized from my childhood and then in my marriage, and we had just never been able to figure that out. And I realized I could actually have an enjoyable sex life with a man that had been healed. And I had gone through years of therapy, you know, all through my marriage, I was in therapy and in and out. And then had so many miracles happen. You know, I'm very transparent about the miracles that happened in my life that kept me alive and that helped me to heal. And then Spencer and I, we were very good to each other through the divorce. We would, we would do activities as a family. We really worked hard to be amicable with our children. And he really stepped up. Like when I was in Europe, he really stepped up and he started cooking for the children. You know, they'd come to his house and see him. And he and my daughter got a tattoo together. And actually this tattoo that they have, she used to look at his face and say, "Look at me, Dad, look at me." And he was kind of bullheaded and he wouldn't, you know, he was kind of preoccupied with his. And so they have these tattoos of this little girl holding this bull's face. And I really could see that he was really trying. And my dream was always for us to be able to be together. There was just so much pain. And neither one of us had the skills, you know, to really create this ultimate relationship. But then when I got home from Europe, we were doing stuff as a family and it just evolved. And I just realized he had healed and he was willing to say he was sorry. He said he was sorry to me. He said he was sorry to the children. And I loved myself. And we both knew that we were 100% in charge of our own happiness at this point. I wasn't depending on him for happiness. He wasn't depending on me. We didn't have that expectation of each other. And we have been deliciously happy since getting married in 2020. Getting married again, I guess I should say.
were all your siblings there? Was it the whole clan?
It was just me and my husband and our four children and our two grandchildren. And then one of our dear friends, she actually she became licensed so she could actually marry us. And we got married at this place called the Church of Dirt on the top of a mountain above Park City, Utah. And it was magical.
When you look back at your life now and reflect, are there things that you do on a daily basis? You talked about waking up, hugging yourself, becoming more embodied. Do you have other exercises or practices that help you to become more embodied as opposed to disassociating?
Absolutely. I would say there's two things. One of the things that I do, it's called going to Bermuda. And it's just a posture that I do at night, at least every night. And I just lay on my bed, and then my bed actually goes up, but you can do it on the wall, but then I just take my feet to a 70 degree angle. And that posture, because it was so integral in my healing, it really just takes me back to that place of mindfulness and just staying focused on, we're never healed. We're always in the process of healing. And then the other thing that I would say, and I would say this is the greatest gift of my life, and that is I work really hard in every moment to choose love, no matter what. No matter what somebody says to me, no matter what somebody does to me, no matter how hurt I feel, I just sit back and process it and just let it, whatever's happening. And then I just choose to respond with love. And for me, that has been the greatest tool I have used.
Earlier, you discussed loving yourself. You didn't value yourself, and you didn't hold your boundaries. In what ways do you hold your boundaries in your relationship, with your work, with friends? Can you kind of give us examples of those different areas? Because so many people struggle with setting and holding.
I have this we all have it. We have the mechanism in ourselves between our nervous system when we are in that peaceful state and when we're in the hypervigilant state. And I do not allow myself to go into that hypervigilant state. I do not, if I start to even feel myself go into an anxious, if the fire alarm goes off in my hotel, then I'll allow myself to go into that anxious state. But for anything else in life, there's just no reason to be in that state. And so if a relationship or a situation is causing me to feel in my sympathetic nervous system, then I make a change. And being peaceful inside of me is a boundary that I hold. Having that time in the morning, it's a kind of a joke between me and my husband now. Even this morning, he says, okay, I'll get out of bed. So, I just say, okay, I need my time. And sometimes, Leo, it's 5 minutes, and sometimes it's an hour. I have no idea how long it's going to be. I just know that I'm going to get out of bed, and when my feet hit the floor, I'm going to be excited for the day ahead of me. And I have a whole process that I do in the morning, of checking in and making sure that I'm not hurting somewhere or emotionally or physically. Because when my feet hit the floor, I'm going to be excited to start my day. And that's a boundary that I hold. I am not around people who do not value me. It was when my mother was slowly passing away. It's one of the greatest blessings of my life that I got to be there when she passed away, because she and I had not talked for years. But even though she was my mom, how she talked to me and how she treated me, it just didn't work. And even though it was heartbreaking for me and it was hard for me in my life, I chose not to be in that relationship. That is a boundary that I set. And I'm very grateful that I was notified as she was passing. And then her and I actually had a couple of months to do a little healing. And then I was with her when she passed. And I truly believe that the reason that I was able to be there is because I had chose love no matter what. But I still kept a boundary, because I did not allow her to treat me poorly anymore.
And that's such a beautiful distinction, because I think that sometimes when we think about a boundary, we think about putting a wall up in between ourselves and someone else, and kind of this all or nothing or black and white type of relationship, where it's like, no, I can set a healthy boundary and still be loving and caring and attentive. But within these rules or, within this structure, so that I still feel safe and supported. Like, how can I love you and still feel safe and supported, right?
Absolutely.
Can you talk to us about the book and who the book is for?
So the book is for anyone who is looking for a connection with themselves, who wants to understand their own personal guidance system, who wants this body to work for them, who is looking for a way to be absolutely unapologetically authentic. The book to create your living blueprint is work. And that's just the first step, because then you have to live from it. And as you and I both know, there are no magic bullets in creating a life that is amazing, that we want to wake up to every day. There's no magic bullet. And this book is for someone who is willing to do the work to figure out why they want to stay on this planet, why they want to live. But it's there. If we're willing to be honest with ourselves, ask for help, and connect to love, we can move through whatever we're dealing with. The book, actually, the catalyst of this book was the suicide of a dear friend. And a promise that I made to him that I would share how I learned to live and how I learned to ask for help and how I learned to be honest no matter what and how I learned to connect to love.
An ultimate question. I always imagine there's someone tuning in who may be on the precipice of wanting to end their life. Before you kill yourself, what would you say to them, Wendy?
If you kill yourself, it is a choice that you cannot come back from. But every other choice, there is an infinite amount of options that you just can't see yet. And as long as you keep that choice on the table, the infinite amount of options will elude you. So slam the door on that choice. Because if you will shut the door on that choice, there are an infinite amount of doors that will open for you.
Last question. What are you looking forward to in the next 24 hours?
It's my grandson's birthday today. So we're having a... I got cupcakes for him and balloons, and we went to Build-A-Bear. And so I cannot wait to play with my little grandson.
I love it. Wendy Beth, this was awesome. Thank you for being here. Thank you, listeners, for tuning in. Remember, this podcast is not a substitute for you calling the 988 or any of the 800 numbers listed in all the show notes. You can chat, talk, text. You can go to thrivewithleo.com for one-on-one coaching with yours truly. Let's get to tomorrow together. Thank you so much, Wendy.
Thank you so much, Leo. It was a pleasure.